This is the last talk of the retreat. I want to try to address the point which I think distinguishes Buddhist practice and Buddhism from other religions, as far as I know, something like the jewel of the Buddhist teaching, and something that trips people up a lot is emptiness. What is that? A thorny topic. There's many of the texts in our tradition, the Pali texts, record conversations that the Buddha had when he was walking around being a teacher, and part of the tradition would be that people would come and try and kind of fight with him or ask him questions like, who are you? What are you doing? You know, you're wrong. My view is better. They would have debates. They would often put a stick in the ground, and then they'd challenge one another to debates. But many of them are just people coming and saying, you know, what are you talking about? So here's one. This is someone named Moga Raja. It's a nice short sutta. The long ones often get me very wound up, so I like the short ones. So, to the one who has seen to the far extreme, I've come with a question. How does one view the world so as not to be seen by death's king? It's a pretty important question. You imagine this guy really thought about something essential he was asking. The Buddha said, view the world, Mogaraja, as empty, always mindful to have removed any view about self. This way, one is above and beyond death. This is how one views the world so as not to be seen by death's king. Okay, so that's very pithy, but very profound also. What would it mean to be beyond death? And I want to note that, of course, the principal self that we're concerned with is me, you know, the me that we're living in all day long. But it also means phenomena, like the, you know, isness of things, our belief that things actually exist and are, you know, as we perceive them and real, which more often the Buddhist stance is that it's sort of like a conjurer's trick or a magic trick. But I'm going to try to go through a little bit to give you a better sense of what he means by empty and what he means by selfless, and how this becomes a direct perception in meditation practice. It's not on the thinking and philosophical level. But, you know, there's always that thing about the finger and the moon. It's a bad example because the moon is so big that you'd see it without a finger, but the finger is needed for some of these things. So here's the... what is that Zen teaching? What's faith? You see this? Okay. Faith. But this is more abstruse here. Okay. So... right view. The first element of the Eightfold Path. The thing that brought you here. The attempt to see. View, it's a perspective or an insight. It's not exactly an argument, although it can sort of be argued or can be described in words, but it's an internal type of knowing. The Buddha was an ordinary person who sort of went to work. He saw the nature of existence, and the way that he saw it also gave him tools for how to deal with existence. So it's a perspective, but also it's a transformation, a transforming perspective, that then from that a sort of life way flows thereafter. And in order to reach this, he didn't have any precedent, so he worked extremely hard. There are stories, which many of you probably know, where he came really to the brink of death, kind of starving himself and sitting in campfires and doing all kinds of things, which at the end he decided was not useful and not helpful. And he kind of came back from that brink And that's also his advice on the middle way to us, that we don't really need to indulge in extremes of asceticism or self-torture. Although what we may have experienced here may seem like... There's worse. But even before he started this attempt of his to discover, you know, the way of life, the happy way of life, he had received the best education in his time, available in his time. And I often think, you know, being married to an anthropologist, I've learned never to think of people as being primitive, you know, to really respect the intelligence of people in other times and cultures, and to sort of try to make some kind of analogy with our own time, to imagine that, you know, if the Buddha were discovering his way of life now, he could have received this same best education that's available now. And some of the alternatives that he discarded are similar to currents that are, you know, prevalent in thinking and acting and life today. So he rejected equally the Brahmin, the caste ideal, in which thoughts were thought to be sort of, metaphysical thoughts were considered to be sort of permanent things that dictated how society should be. This was a not very empirical system, but you could compare it, say, to Marxism or other kinds of, you know, purely conceptual philosophies today that were used to structure society. It's like a metaphysical, conceptual thing. He also discarded the ascetic alternative. I'm talking loudly for Anne, but can you hear well? Can you hear me okay? Okay. In which people were looking for an eternal substrate that is sort of hidden behind things through intensive concentration to try to sort of penetrate through appearances and find what is sort of like behind everything, some kind of stillness, some kind of source origin, which is similar to what many theistic religions now do, you know, sort of impute that there's kind of some one or something or some, you know, otherness that is hidden that we can find. Neither one of these alternatives gives credence to ordinary senses or the texture of our experience here and now, which, as you notice, we have been trying to get you to connect with, and how hard is that? But anyway, so the Buddha just kind of plopped himself down between those two extremes of taking a thought and imposing it on reality, or trying to go past reality into something beyond thought, beyond everything. So he kind of went right into life as it is lived, and came up with this insight, which is that everything is connected to everything else, and nothing exists on its own. That thing, you know, time and space and experience are all arising one thing after another, and they kind of need each other, and this is what existence is. There's nothing beyond this, and this is all empty of a self, that this idea of a self is only an idea, and if you look a little bit more closely, it is not real, or it's not corresponding to the way things actually function, and it creates a lot of problems. So to be empty of a self, and to recognize that and experience, and to sort of destroy that, you know, your activity that comes from that assumption that, you know, like these ego needs that we have and this sense of things, is freedom. But it is not independence. It is not going off by yourself to a cave and eating nuts and berries and becoming like completely irrelevant to everything. So there's so many ramifications to this discovery of his, to this total orientation of his, that it's kind of unspeakable. I think if I were Eric, I would stop here and go deep with this, but I'm not going to. I'm going to, in my own way, move on as rapidly as possible. Because we have miles to go before we sleep. So the Buddha said, this is him speaking when people, you know, it's all over the suttas, this whole thing about dependent arising. This fact is difficult to perceive, hard to comprehend, peaceful, delightful, not given by reasoning. People delighting in attachment, nourished by and engrossed in attachment, will perceive it with difficulty. This is from the Ariya Pariyasana Sutta, where he's described his own practice about how he went deep, deep, deep in concentration and didn't find it, and then came out. So it is not an abandoning of sense experience. It is not an abandoning of pleasure. It is not an abandoning of unpleasantness. It is an abandoning of craving. Dunk. Okay. It is seeing reality as it is and being able to sort of correspond with that. To be able to perceive it correctly and to be able to respond correctly, adequately. That is the way out of suffering. So craving can only arise with wrong view. So our wrongful view of life, the thing that keeps us going at things problematically, you know, both individually and collectively, big time, is this ignorance that we've been talking about too. Our essential belief in self, our belief that our self is permanent, like who in here does not believe that I exist, and who in here doesn't have that subjective sense that there's something kind of finally real and eternal about the me-ness in us? There's countless people argued with the Buddha on this point. And there are other religions that say that this seeming eternity of the I is the reason why the soul is eternal. I mean, there's a totally other argument for it, saying that this subjective impression that we have means that God meant us to be me. And I'm not going to argue with that now. I'm just going to say what the Buddha said. So he, when he describes his own practice, he says he went up the states of concentration and absorption until he attained such a state of concentration that perception and feeling ceased. When he saw that perception, which is the, you know, it's defined as the thing that's the sort of the thing that sees that this is a knob, it's the part of our mind that sort of is able to define, you know, things out of the substrate to, you know, to tell an object apart from the field and to kind of give it a name and to say that yellow is yellow and all that stuff. And feeling being, you know, the perception of whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. When he saw that these things could cease, then he realized that they weren't final and the word empty was applied to them. So that they aren't necessarily, you know, sort of eternal parts of existence or parts of experience even. They were not truly or inherently existing. They were compounded because they, you know, by definition, if they can come to an end, then they are not, you know, sort of final and not. So they are unstable, they are moving around, they are interdependent upon things. Like if there wasn't a knob here, then I wouldn't be able to call it a knob. So there's always kind of something, as Rosanna used to say. So everything is interdependent. And here I have the sutta on foam I was mentioning the last time. Let's see. Monks suppose that a large glob of foam were floating down the Ganges River, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. What substance would there be in a glob of foam? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any form that is past, future, or present, inner or outer, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in form? And then he goes through all the aggregates of perception. Well, you know, if we think about it cognitively, we know that. Like, we know that we're all mostly made out of space and all that stuff about, you know, I love thinking that it's really the protons' fault that we think that we exist, because they're the thing that are responsible for it's the neutrons. Dave is going to get me over there, I know. That if the neutrons were to be released from their atomic bonds, everything would disappear within 15 minutes. But because they're in there, everything seems to kind of have some stability. But that is a concept. I mean, it approaches us to a sense of how, you know, weird things are. But, you know, we know that we're made out of, we have heart and organs and brain. And when they look at the brain, there's no driver in there. There's no little part in the middle where the, you know, main operator is that looks out through your eyes. You know, they know that. But we don't know that. Right? We think that we're somebody, and we think we're in here, and most of us probably think that we're kind of either here or here. or, you know, so, or in our thoughts or in our feelings or somewhere that, you know, we've kind of hidden it, but, you know, like we left it in the drawer wrapped up in some socks and it's still running things. It's kind of, we don't always look at it, but we know it's there. Right here, I think Fred says, like it's on your shoulder, kind of. So many suttas. Then when he's talking to Ananda, he talks about there's this sort of regress that goes back to the mind and the body depending on each other, and you can, they kind of, there's nothing that kind of goes back before that. There's, if, you know, we know that our mind and our body are kind of stuck together, like when our mind and body separate, that's called death, right? And we discussed today that we are not sure quite where the mind goes. And we know the body eventually just crumbles into nothing and disappears. And after, when the body has crumbled into nothing and disappears, the mind that was associated with that body isn't there. So the mind and body operate back and forth. And, you know, say like, if I pinch you, you have an unpleasant feeling and you say, ow, and then you see me and you don't like me. And so there's mental and physical chains that go back and forth. You know, it's, you can have a gut feeling about someone that comes from your brain, because there are actually intestinal cells in your brain that connect to your intestine that tell you sort of very emotional information and stuff like that. You know, it's crazy how we're all kind of, you know, what do you call it, a patchwork of very different things. So his idea was that directing individuals toward this reality is a helpful thing. It's not scary, it's good. It doesn't mean that you're going to lose something that you need, it's going to be that you're going to get rid of something that is hurting you. So when you see clearly in this way, you see that there's no basis for attachment, and that in a way is why we're kind of looking at ourselves over and over and over until we finally get it. Like there's a type of additive thing that happens with this practice. You know, it was, he took six years to get to be a Buddha, and it is not overnight that you see it. It's kind of like those, you know, those crazy pictures that you look at and you have to put your nose in the right place and all of a sudden you see. It's like you watch your experience more and more and more and you start to see it in different ways, and then finally you kind of get it. It's like, oh my God, there is no reason to hang on to this. Or, oh, this is just a thought. I don't have to go with this. You know, I'm you know, I just see it going by here like a balloon. And it's gone, and now I don't have to do that, or I don't have to make that phone call. And when, you know, when it's away, you feel the relief, you know. But seeing it directly is very different from kind of just working with it without this kind of special vipassana connection. So all of his explanations about these things are in a way a meditation instruction or a perceptual instruction for us. His two main disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, both got liberated and enlightened by hearing him say, of those things that arise from a cause, the enlightened one, or the thus gone one, has explained the cause. And of those things that arise from a cause, their cessation has he also explained. So everything that arises passes away. And they got it, and that was it for them. There was nothing, there was no more for them to cling to. Everything that you see will disappear. Everything that is happening will soon not be happening. So why hang on? So in a way, this is very, you know, this makes sense in a structural, conceptual way, but the concepts do not work to liberate us. You know, it's not accessible by thought. It's only accessible by this rubber meets the road kind of practice that we've been doing, looking. And, you know, we often, I mean, I feel like in my practice, I try to get my experience and bring it up close so I can see it, and it's actually not that substantial, so I sort of have to let it be, and it's kind of weirdness the way it is, and then even try to look at it there. It's not easy. But that's the only way, because it's a combination of sort of the sensory input and seeing thoughts as thoughts, not being drawn into their content, that's where this sort of special yogic perception gets built up. It is, I'm just going to use that word because I think it's a helpful way of thinking about what we're doing here, that there is such a thing as a type of, you know, specialized perception that's a result of this kind of practice. So you do this practice, you only do it, and then the result is built up over time. And like, there have been times in very intensive retreats, like Upandita's retreats, where I've thought to myself, like, what the hell am I doing to my brain chemistry here? I mean, it is so weird. you know, the slowing down, the not sleeping, the eating less, the creeping around, the, you know, paying attention night and day, and, you know, and the interviews and getting this, like, very specified verbal input that sort of keeps torquing your perception and these little instructions and stuff like that. It is, you know, if you think of it in those sort of scientific ways, we are really doing a number on ourselves here. And when they tell you not to indulge in distractions, it's for a reason. It's to keep you on track in that sense, you know, sort of in the transformative way. Which is why some retreats are tight, but, you know, there's also a lot of value in sort of, you know, there are very different ways to skin this cat, but this present moment awareness is very crucial. So anyway, it is this thing that he discovered that he thought was of infinite value for human life. And it is an operational skill. It's something that you have to put into practice. Otherwise, nothing happens. And it has to be done by each person individually and internally. And everyone's mind is different. And everyone's way of hearing this is very different. And that's why, you know, there are, you know, all different kinds of teachers, all different kinds of retreats, all different kinds of stuff. But again, it's not just metaphysical. There's something like some ethics of perception, some, you know, great way of using your awareness. And he was not really very interested in where the universe began. He would always say, like, don't even think about that, and don't even think about why we might have this problem of ignorance. Just get to work and bring it to an end. Bring your problem to an end. That's the only thing that really matters. So he's also been called a radical empiricist. Which, you know, means someone who just takes what they see, feel, and hear. There's a sort of aspect in this that is of complete responsibility on the practitioner, on the individual, that no one can do this for you. A lot of us really love this part, you know, but unfortunately no one can kind of do it to you either, mm-hmm. you know. I wish, a lot of times. But, you know, there is some kind of influence that we get from being around people who embody it. I mean, it's a kind of a human connection thing. Like, I was going to try to call this the Dharma coughing fit and see if, you know, I don't know if I've infected anyone with a cold, but hopefully some, you know, germs of meaning will get across here also. But, okay. So we have the power to do this. We can learn this. We can observe dependent arising in our own experience. Now, to talk about karma and the metaphysical mechanisms of that, he also said that that was profound and hard to see, like maybe even more profound and harder to see than this dependent arising thing. There's something satisfying about the fact that it's not sort of God, like, twiddling his finger and destroying Sodom and Gomorrah. It's sort of nature and human beings, and as Eric said, it's greed, hatred, and delusion. I mean, there's so much clarity in that, and in, you know, discerning that it's not necessarily a cultural, these are the parts that I think are really not cultural. Let's see, so for him, when he saw karma and lives and stuff like that, that was really a result of the incredible mental training that the Buddha was able to do in his six. I mean, he was a clearly really talented person, and they said that, legendarily, they said that he spent, you know, eons upon eons of lifetimes developing all of the strength of mind so that his insight would be profound enough not just to liberate him, but that he could help us too and leave this kind of spoken, intelligent legacy, and also have whatever the charisma was that he needed and the social position and stuff. But just to say that he had a lot of sort of power behind his insights. So to be able to see the past and future in yourself and others, and to have all these higher knowledges, isn't necessary just for our own liberation. The most basic view and understanding is this type of, what, you know, gnosis or insight or intuition, whereby you see this conditionality and you see that there's no reason to hang on. And in that seeing, there's a way that there's something else that happens in the mind where it sort of like goes beyond into the unborn, the untouched, the beyond space-time, which isn't a thing and isn't a place and isn't, you know, anything, but when there is like, you know, when your practice gets developed and then sort of like the surface of reality breaks apart and the chain is broken for a minute and you sort of like see through, then you come back and you're just all involved in it again, but certain things are gradually extinguished by those various visions, or in our tradition called stages of insight or stages of liberation. But the basic ignorance is reduced. Nowadays, hardly anybody goes all the way to complete purification in one go. Like, it takes a few stages, it takes a few times. But the main thing is that as we crave to be more of what we are, or to become this kind of very deep part of us that isn't really in accordance with seeing things as they are, you can hear the great joy in all of the Buddha's followers and in himself when he describes that that is extinguished. That's what he was talking about when he says, like, it would be like, to me, I think that you guys are all like lepers rolling in the fire to get the scratch off you guys by, you know, doing more sensual pleasures or trying to, you know, from where I sit, that just looks so torturous compared to not craving anymore. Okay. So that, it was a little bit of a middle of the retreat type of discourse, but I feel like it's so important in Buddhism that, and it's so important for your practice that I just thought you should hear it. And I want to go on and describe a little bit about how that operates to break the chain. Now, this rest of the talk is a little bit of a patchwork. Okay. There's a saying, this is starting for the retreat is going to end soon, and this is an artificial designation, obviously, like this is a place to examine dependent arising, that we have given a label as the end of the retreat, and some people might have started thinking about the end of the retreat early this morning, or, you know, in the middle of the day, or, you know, when is it actually going to end? And endings and beginnings are happening all the time, and our thoughts seem to establish these things. You know, and we all can sort of make similar thoughts and arrive in the room at the same time and go home at the same time and, you know, all of this, but it's totally artificial. It's a very great mystery, even how that works. But for this journey, or for a retreat, or for our life, there's a saying called, begin by not being discouraged, end with not being ashamed, and in between, live with pure wisdom. So the beginning of not being discouraged is like when Eric talked about the Beatles song, you know, that it is possible to be liberated. It's possible to change. It's possible to ameliorate your state. Through this practice of moment-to-moment observation and awareness, using loving-kindness and discernment. 10 or 15 years ago, I remember I went into an acupuncture appointment and I told the practitioner that I thought I was the worst person that I knew. And today I'm, you know, extremely far from that, and I also... you know, sometimes I actually use things from interviews. So the people who are in the interviews, please don't think that I'm doing that to embarrass you. But I heard someone today say that they thought they were the worst person. And I feel like I can tell that person that I was you. And I'm not like that. Now, I don't have to feel that way now because of the, you know, because of this practice and because of engaging with all different kinds of healing things in order to get my mind away from believing that kind of, you know, terribly destructive and damaging and painful thought, and taking that as real, taking that as self, taking that as me. Now, I'm not saying that I'm perfect or that I don't have any, you know, pockets of rotten stuff in there, you know, that are still driving me in various painful ways, and you know, the inadequacies and fears and despairs and stuff like that. But I don't think I'm the worst person anymore. I really don't, and I did. Time and again, this practice has revealed to me all kinds of different wonderful things. Like, sometimes I have had to be dragged through some of those pus pockets in order to get out of them, like to sort of open them up and let them air out rather than just being kind of hidden in there. But I have it on good authority, and I think really all of us have it on good authority, that there is such a thing as inner change. I mean, after all, we've changed from being a child to being an adult, and there are certain things that we no longer believe, and, you know, we know how to read. Our mind has actually changed and grown over the years. And it's very important to believe that in this kind of heart level we can also change, that there can be a degree of happiness that grows, something like dawn coming over the mountain that you don't know if it's getting lighter, but then suddenly after an hour you realize it is a lot lighter than it was an hour ago. I know that, you know, when I was a teenager, to me there was no such thing as a reliable adult or authority figure. I don't think I could have talked to anyone. I was, you know, now when I see kids who are the way I was, I feel really sad, and I really know what they feel like, because I was that person then. And for me to be where I am now is a really long distance. I mean, even any distance at all from that completely shut down, angry place is giant. I mean, even if it was an inch, but I've come a number of miles from there. Now, saying that our mind and body change moment by moment, our inner reality and our outer reality are constantly changing, and there's no two moments that are ever the same. And it might be that we establish this self just out of some kind of need for conventions, you know, sort of why we get here all at the same time, all of us different people, and all of us with our watches different. And internally we do some of the same things, like we give each other a name so that, like, we can, like, talk to you again the same day. You know, like, you turn, you know, even though you're a little bit different than you were yesterday, I can still get you to turn around by naming you, you know, stuff. But then some of the other things that we think about each other are not so good, and if you think that, well, someone said something horrible 6 years ago, and you still, you know, how many of us still believe that we don't like someone because of thinking of their character structure 6 years ago without leaving any room for them to have grown and developed. Anyway, the fact that there is mental cause and effect, that there can be mental growth and there can be mental damage, is something that this practice intervenes in. It's meant to intervene in this hopeful, positive way. This putting awareness in the present moment, you know, transforms your mind toward more and more happiness. The word dharma means nature, and there's a lot that Buddhism has in common with science in sort of its pragmatism and stuff, but it's considered like more like a science of the heart-mind. It's very easy to make a relationship with empirical science, but this inner part is super important for us. So we're intervening in this crucial way and, like, kind of taking charge of our process in this practice. So why would we not be discouraged, or why should we be discouraged or not discouraged? It's because there really is something called, like, affliction or problem that on any level we can all acknowledge that we have some of it. You know, some of us have more, some of us have less, but we all have some amount of problems. Aging, sickness, death, neurosis, trauma, love gone wrong. Don't be discouraged. Offer this hope to one another and to yourself that it's possible to change. So, you know, that's part of what the job of a teacher is, to try to, you know, touch upon people when they're willing to open up in their pain in an interview or in a retreat, to say that this is good, that it's opened in a way toward healing, and it's not just that, you know, it's just making everything bad. So getting to the middle part, in the middle, live with pure wisdom, to live with the practice, to look inside ourselves, to investigate, acknowledge the problem. That's the beginning of right view. To recognize our grief and our lamentation and our despair and our stuckness and the things that feel like they're rolled into a ball inside us that we can't get rid of. So try to gain knowledge, inner and direct knowledge of the cause and effect process in ourselves, as the Buddha did. See suffering and also see the end of suffering, or the quenching of suffering. That in the very recognition of the ugliness and the hollowness and the oppression that is part of everybody's life, that when you see what that is, that there's within the context of these teachings, there's a liberating element. It's not just sort of to gross you out or make you unhappy. The word dharma also means virtue, and this kind of awareness that's combined with wisdom or an intelligence about what we're looking at should be called virtuous in the most profound sense. It's nothing goody-goody. It's like sterling. It's ultimate. It's so beautiful. It's, you know, Eric's talk yesterday, love and wisdom, these lights that shine in our world. We need to get the mind to be firm and steady to some degree to be able to look inside reliably. That's the concentration part. Also the morality part, but I'm not going to cover that right now. But you have to be able to have a steady enough attention to look your feelings and emotions in the face and ask them, you know, as I was saying to one person today, for their ID card, like, what are you or who are you? Like, before you come in the door, I want you to tell me who you are. And when you can look at thoughts, emotions, and feelings in the face without getting carried away, you begin to see that they are in the nature of foam, that they're just very ephemeral. In fact, there's this one crazy Gelugpa Lama named Lama Zopa Rinpoche who talks for hours and hours. I don't know if any of you have ever been to a teaching of his, but he talks with his eyes shut. I mean, he is really insane, and he talks about, and your ego, it's not that! It's not there. When you look at it, it's like, what the hell is this? Where are these thoughts? Like, where do they exist? Do they have a location? Where do they come from? When they disappear, where do they go? Like, where were all those thoughts you were having this morning that were torturing you this morning? New ones are torturing you now, but tonight, other ones will be torturing you, and the ones that are torturing you now won't be torturing you. I mean, what is it? Okay, so it's... So, it's all the neutrons' fault, right? But it's like everything is this web of conditions, and it's so much more ephemeral than we give it credit for. We give it way so much more credit. We just let all these thugs into the house, and we say, like, okay, you know, sit, eat. You know, you're okay, you're who you say you are. Huh. But so now, just in order to bring the talk closer to an end, I'm going to describe one chain of cause and effect, which is, it's the perceptual chain and how it works moment to moment. Like, say, you're listening to me, right? So you're listening to me, you can hear me because you have ears and because you are paying attention. There are sounds that could be happening that you're not paying attention to that you don't hear. You know, say like this buzzing behind me. Most of you probably haven't been hearing that, but if I bring your attention to it, you'll hear it, right? So there has to be a sound. You have to have your ear. Your attention has to be there, and then there's something that, what they call ignition. So you're having an experience of the sound, also the meaning, but you can, just sticking with the sound now, there's a sound heard because your ears are working, because you're not deaf. So you need all this to come together to have the talk. So, and you're not really seeing it like that, are you? You're just sort of experiencing the talk, and just like I'm experiencing talking as a blob or as something that I take for granted. So the ear, the sound, the attention. Say the word sex. Now what? Right? Okay. That sounds great to some people and horrible to others. You know, so say I say the word sex, or I say the word chocolate ice cream, or I say steaks, or I say, you know, death, or something like that. Some feeling comes in the mind, like you interpret the meaning. The mind, like, jumps up to your ear and starts interpreting the meaning of what I say and brings feeling. You know, maybe you have some feelings about how loud I'm talking or how fast I'm talking that are pleasant or unpleasant. associated with things from the past, and here comes your whole karmic apparatus to the sound and starts to create an experience that is like, oh, so she's there, And I'm here, being me, with all my associations, my perceptions. This is called formation. Actually, perception is where you hear my voice and you start to get the meaning. You hear the, and you think that there's a me here talking and stuff like that. And then formations is the impression that you get of this whole thing. And actually, it's much more in flux than we really perceive. And that's why this practice tells you to start to really look deeper, 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 like to, you know, when you hear a voice, to also be able sometimes to just discern the sound. And if you just hear the sound, like I have a friend who loves to, I'm not recommending this, get high and listen to music and try to figure out where's the music and where's him. You know, where does it enter me? Is there a boundary between the music and my listening and me and, you know, the production of the music and stuff like that? It's very difficult not to start getting into the foam if you start to look very, very closely at what's going on. And this is like a reality from the inside, not a reality from what you've read in books or what you've heard or what anyone else can agree on. It has to be completely in this kind of subjective realm. So we almost never experience things as such. We experience a glob. We don't experience this extremely rapid chain reaction very often. You know, I mean, sometimes when I wake up, I don't know where I am or I don't know who I am. And then, you know, and then I arrive, I'm, you know, there's kind of like, whoa. And then it's like, oh, right. You know, here I am in the Madonna Center. I have to go down and teach the retreat. I'm in New Mexico. You know, everything kind of comes. And then I'm like, whew, okay, I've got it now. You know? And it's not like we're trying to become a blank. We're not trying to get rid of all this. We're trying to see what it is. That's why, actually, you know, you have to let the emotions be there. You have to let the experience be there. Otherwise, you won't see it. Like, there's often this feeling that we have to get rid of it all or sweep it away or, like, when our perceptions come in, I feel like often like I have to clip all the hairs off them and get them really neat and then look at them. No, you leave the hair on and look at it in all of its messiness, because then you'll see what it is. Don't fix it. Don't correct it. So, and this sequencing thing has gigantic implications for reality and for life externally and out of the retreat. You know, PTSD, for example, a stimulus takes somebody right back to Iraq or when someone, you know. I've been talking a lot to this psychologist who I love, who does tests on racism and ageism and fatism and homophobia and stuff, where you have to click on a screen and try to associate, you know, good and bad things with black and white faces and stuff like that. And, you know, why do police... She said, like, she's done a lot of tests on police. They equally well shoot someone with a gun in their hand, no matter what race or gender they are. But a black man with a cell phone is very easy to kill. You know, they just kill black men with cell phones, you know, in those firing range tests. And it's very hard for them to not do it. And it's because we associate, like, violence with black men. I mean, sorry, you know, this is culture. It's horrible. And it's very hard to admit that this is happening. But one of the good things is that it's just a mechanistic thing. It's not you. I mean, if the police could all go to a Buddhism course, they would be much more receptive to her training. She said that when they're forced to go to her trainings, they all put their hats down. They say they're forced to be in the room, but they won't watch because they feel, I think they feel they're public servants and they're doing their best and they're in a violent environment and they don't want to hear that they would ever kill someone by mistake. It's too threatening for them, you know. But this aggregate of perception includes so much kind of information and environmental stuff. Like, this is really good for us because she said that the only people who have direct access to modifying their perceptions are people who do yoga and meditators. And that's it. She said, like, you guys are great. She said, you guys are my hope for this world. That when I tell you, just don't perceive it that way, people who've done a lot of meditation practice can undo it. That's stunning. She said there's one kind of meditation that doesn't work for that, and she said TM does not work to unpack your perception. I don't know why. She said she doesn't like TM for that reason. But people who do hatha yoga, I guess you focus enough on your, you know, specifics of your body and your experience, or people who do vipassana, she said, we're great. So we can congratulate ourselves. But, and she also said that, you know, these things can be modified over time, like, you know, by your environment, by your training, by your education, by changing your screensaver, by who you hang out with, that people can deliberately induce these kind of sea changes in these, like, knee-jerk responses. So it is trainable, and meditation gives you so much more access to producing wholesome responses. Now, this is what we were all trying to say, right? And it's great that some parts of science have come in and started to extract, you know, stuff that, you know, I'm sure that they're going to discover that Buddhism is terrible for you in some other ways at some point, but right now, we're golden. Everybody's studying us and everything is turning out so great, you know. We're lucky. Anyway, so voidness or sunyata is not nothing. It's not a big nothing. It's seeing the interrelationship and, to some degree, being able to unpick it and see the nature of things. As Eric has said a few times, to understand is to forgive. To see this nothingness really allows so much more freedom and movement in the heart. So it's the law of nature, this causality. You know, because of this, then there's that. When this is not, then that is not. So that when craving stops, then pain stops and suffering stops and rebirth stops. So less and less investment in this I belief. Less and less ignorance, glue, more and more being present. We're all sort of working to reduce this root delusion of ourselves. And to say this thing about the I belief, just, it's not, you know, the upright capital, it's not just a letter. It is that sensation of, like, solid reality that we have about ourselves, that is, if we're ontologically complete and final. All right. So mindfulness arrives on time and it delivers the insight. So that's kind of where we want to intervene, right here in the present moment. With it, you know, it's sort of a lubricant that your sense organs and your mind will operate a lot more naturally. I haven't said very much about the home-going things. Do you want me to or no? Let's see. No. Live without regret. Every moment counts. I guess that's the end. Thank you. Thank you for listening. May we all come to understand this in a very profound, internal, from the core of our heart kind of way.